Today is Monday, August 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What's next for Beirut after a weekend of protests?
So far, we have three ministers who have resigned in Lebanon and calls to investigate further and to hold those in power responsible for what happened.
Plus, what do people fear in Hong Kong as a prominent pro-democracy advocate is arrested?
A lot of people are just quite on edge, and they're very concerned about what's to come and what that means for the future of press freedom.
And concerns in Europe over the recent election in Belarus. Those stories and more are all next. French President Emmanuel Macron hosted an emergency donors conference on Sunday, urging world leaders to support Beirut after its devastating explosion. Speaking to reporters as he departed New Jersey, U.S. President Donald Trump says the United States is sending emergency humanitarian aid to Lebanon.
We've had three major planes already over with a lot of medical, mostly medical equipment and various things to help. We have some excellent military that do this, and they've reported back that they've never seen anything like this before. So it's a horrific situation, but we'll help.
But on the streets of the Lebanese capital, protests erupted over the weekend calling for accountability and for the government to step down. And on Monday, that happened with Prime Minister Hassan Diab and his cabinet doing so. Reporter George Eade via WhatsApp.
We had also many MPs, parliament members, who resigned accordingly and withdrew from the parliament because they believe that the parliament and the cabinet is no longer legitimate. So during the weekend, thousands took on the streets. A lot of them were injured as security forces fired rubber bullets during the weekends, and many were injured. Two among those were journalists.
George, have we learned anything more about the investigation into what led to the explosion?
The Lebanese government had given an investigative committee 4 days to determine responsibility for the explosion. However, until now, we do not have any valid reason or just something to tell us what really happened on the port, although investigations are going on, and although that we know that the Lebanese government has 16 or more than 16 individuals in custody. A lot of other people were brought in by the Justice Department to listen to their statements. However, the nature of the explosion is still a mystery and is not determined. We know that it came from Georgia. We know a vessel was transporting it and in an illegal way. We know it was meant to go to Africa, but on the way we had a different crew that took on the ship and brought it to Lebanon, and here it remained until the explosion. So these are interesting enough. We also have seen the captain of the ship go on the media and different media outlets outside Lebanon and tell he told the story. The captain of the ship told the story through different media outlets, and he specified that he entered Lebanon where the merchandise was or the explosives were deposited.
This weekend, you had the opportunity to meet many of those who are carrying out the search and rescue operations. What can you tell us about that experience?
Well, we had the chance to get acquainted to the rescue teams from around six countries who are working around the clocks. What we discovered is that it's a very hard mission pulling the people under the rubble. As we speak today, two people were pulled from under the rubble. We have a total of more than 159 people dead, 6,000 injured, and 300,000 homeless. These rescue teams are working to try and find out if they can pull out more of the bodies of those who were present. Another team is starting now to prepare for the for a thorough investigation on the nature of the explosion. So the teams working on the ground are doing their best.
George Eade reports from Beirut, Lebanon. Hong Kong media tycoon and democracy advocate Jimmy Lai was one of seven people arrested on Monday on charges of violating the new national security law that China has imposed. Ria Mogul shares the latest from Hong Kong via WhatsApp.
So police arrested Jimmy Lai, his two sons, and several other staff over alleged violations of the national security law. Now, Jimmy Lai was specifically arrested for collusion with foreign forces. He's a very well-known pro-democracy figure in Hong Kong. He's the owner of Apple Daily, which is, you know, very strongly pro-democracy in Hong Kong. It's a newspaper. And yeah, the media were completely kept out of the loop. In fact, before 10 a.m. this morning, over 200 police officers raided the offices of Apple Daily, acting on a search warrant. And there have been several images, videos that have flooded social media showing a large number of officers walking through offices, you know, looking through desks of reporters, looking through files, papers, that sort of thing. You know, and then there were images of Jimmy Lai being escorted from his home in Kowloon to the police station. Now, he's given many interviews in the past saying that it's just a matter of time before he gets arrested.
The Hong Kong Foreign Correspondents Club immediately released a very strongly worded statement condemning the actions against Jimmy Lai and on Apple Daily. What's been the reaction to this development in Hong Kong?
That's right. Yeah, on social media, multiple organizations, including the Foreign Correspondents Club, the FCC, Amnesty International, the Hong Kong Journalists Association, they've all condemned this act. You know, they're calling it a complete erosion of a free press here in Hong Kong. You know, the FCC said, and I quote, that the raids are a direct assault on a free press and press freedom, and called it a dark new phase in Hong Kong and in its global reputation. And a lot of, you know, activists, Joshua Wong, just regular Hong Kong people, have been expressing their sadness, expressing their anger over what's happened here in Hong Kong today. It was pretty interesting to see all of these images being shared so widely of police officers raiding a newsroom. You know, that's pretty unprecedented and it's unexpected. So a lot of people are just, you know, quite on edge, and they're very concerned about what's to come and what that means for the future of press freedom, the future of news in Hong Kong.
I suspect discussions are taking place not only about the future of press freedom in Hong Kong, but the future there itself, because the national security law was implemented because of pro-democracy protests. So what are people saying?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because the response from Apple Daily was, you know, pretty straightforward. Reporters live streamed the entire event on Facebook, on their website. And, you know, they remain committed to continuing, you know, their daily work as to be expected. They publish news articles. So people are still going on as if, you know, as if they were in, before these national security laws came into effect. They're still doing their jobs. They're still publishing news articles. Of course, there still is an element of fear. People are still, some people are, you know, not publishing their names, not asking for their bylines to be written down in certain news stories, especially if they're quite controversial or if they talk about the national security laws. But if Apple Daily's response is anything to go by, they live streamed the entire event. You know, that's why we have all of these images of the police raiding their offices and going through files and cabinets and things like that. So people are still pretty committed, and in fact, very committed to reporting the facts and reporting what's going on here in Hong Kong.
Ria Mogul reports from Hong Kong. U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar offered President Donald Trump strong support for Taiwan Monday, telling President Tsai Ing-wen that her government's response to the coronavirus pandemic has been among the world's best. Reuters' Gloria So has that story.
Azar's visit is a landmark meeting. He's the highest level U.S. official to go to Taiwan in four decades. His trip angered China, which claims the Democratic Island as its own. It's ratcheting up already soaring tension between the U.S. and China, and Beijing has promised unspecified retaliation. During his visit, Azar praised Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen and her government's response to the global pandemic as among the world's best.
Again, I am grateful to President Tsai for welcoming us to Taiwan, and I look forward to using this visit to convey our admiration for Taiwan and to learn about how our shared democratic values have driven success in health.
Meanwhile, Tsai told Azar his visit represented a huge step forward in anti-pandemic collaborations between our countries, specifically mentioning vaccine and drug research and production. Taiwan has also expressed gratitude for U.S. support of its bid for greater access to the World Health Organization, particularly attendance at the World Health Assembly. Taiwan is currently not a member of the WHO due to China's objections, a decision which Tsai criticized again on Monday.
I would like to reiterate that political consideration should never take precedence over the right to health. The decision to bar Taiwan from participating in the WHA is a violation of the universal right to health.
Washington first broke off official ties with Taipei in 1979 in favor of Beijing, but the Trump administration has made boosting arms sales and strengthening its support for the island a priority.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. Police in Belarus used stun grenades, tear gas, and a water cannon in a crackdown on thousands of protesters who took to the streets of Minsk late Sunday over the election there. To get the latest, I spoke with Charles Maines in Moscow via WhatsApp.
This election was supposed to be the most challenging of longtime Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko's career, or it appeared to be until the results came in. The official results say that Lukashenko won 80% of the vote, with just 10% going to his most serious challenger. That's Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. She's a housewife who entered this race only because her husband, a popular political blogger and would-be candidate, was denied the ballot and thrown in jail. Now, Tikhanovskaya attracted huge crowds in the run-up to Election Day, and which made this result of 10% look even more suspicious. She's come out today and says she rejects the results. They have, she says, proof that many just the opposite was true, that she won many of these precincts, and she's appealing to the Electoral Commission. As you noted, thousands came out on the streets last night. Dozens were injured in a tense standoff with Lukashenko's riot troops in central Minsk, and also some other cities around the country. You know, many will say this was actually quite predictable, that first of all, that Lukashenko would win. He controls the election apparatus. And they also say the protests were predictable. These were huge rallies. People basically were waiting to happen.
Poland, Germany, and others have come out saying that the election didn't meet standards. So what can the EU effectively do in this case?
Well, that's right. The EU condemned what they called disproportionate and unacceptable state violence against peaceful protesters. They called for a fair count. But the truth is, they probably can do very little. I mean, Belarus is also, Lukashenko, I should say, has often played this kind of game between East and West. He's used Belarus's sort of foreign policy as his bargaining chip, where sometimes he drifts into Russia's orbit. And when it's convenient, he sort of drifts towards Europe. But, you know, I think what's interesting here is the protesters themselves say they don't want a street revolution. They want an honest count. But Lukashenko really has given them little choice but to go out into the streets. And so we're stuck in this showdown between the state security apparatus and a very, very united opposition at this point. I think it's also worth pointing out here that while Lukashenko has faced challenges before and come out ahead, frankly, he's been in power now for 26 years, the only post-Soviet president Belarus is really known, you know, this time people say it's different. And the reason is the COVID pandemic. Lukashenko, people might remember, he paid really little heed to the global pandemic. He mocked it as essentially mass hysteria. And as the body count went up and people got infected and people were having shortages of equipment at hospitals around the country, you know, it wasn't the government that helped out. It was civil society. People stepped in to fill the void. And I think what they did came out of that was this lesson that they don't need Lukashenko, and they're working around him. And that seems to be one of the conclusions that people have come to, that he may have the post as president or the title officially, but in their eyes, he's no longer their leader.
What can you tell us about Natalia Shklerov, who's kind of been held in somewhat of a loose connection with all this?
He's a political consultant. He's worked in campaigns both in the U.S. and in Russia, frankly. I've met him and interviewed him before. But he is a Belarus national, a native of Minsk originally, and he was arrested late last month and held for 60 days. Now, last week, you know that there was a court case held on August 4th, a hearing in which the court rejected calls to release him. But they've also yet to present any formal charges. that we know of. And in theory, that means they would have to release him even if he remains a suspect in the eyes of the state. But again, I think it's worth noting that in Alexander Lukashenko's Belarus, the state really determines the rules. There are formal rules, but they're not often observed. So we're waiting to see.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow. And coming up later,
Afghanistan agreed on Sunday to release 400 hardcore Taliban prisoners, paving the way for the beginning of peace talks aimed at ending 19 years of war.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Seismologists from Rice University in Houston, Texas, have made the first direct measurements of three geological layers of Mars, from its crust to its core. The scientists use seismic data from NASA's InSight lander to determine the boundaries between each layer of the red planet. Because of the lack of plate tectonics on Mars, the scientists say much of its subsurface geological history has remained virtually untouched. The seismologists found that the distance between the red planet's crust and mantle is about 35 kilometers. The scientists noted a transitional zone within Mars' mantle located about 1,110 and 1,170 kilometers under the lander. Finally, Mars' core begins between 1,520 and 1,600 kilometers below the lander. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. India on Monday reported more than 1,000 new coronavirus deaths, the most the country has recorded in a single day since the pandemic began. The new toll puts India's total at 44,386 deaths, trailing only the United States, Brazil, Mexico, and Britain. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said there is still hope to get the pandemic under control.
This week, we will reach 20 million registered cases of COVID-19 and 750,000 deaths. Behind these statistics, there is a great deal of pain and suffering. Every life lost matters. I know many of you are grieving and that this is a difficult moment for the world. But I want to be clear, there are green shoots of hope, and no matter where a country, a region, a city, or a town is, it's never too late to turn the outbreak around.
Public health experts agree, wear a mask, wash your hands, and observe physical distancing. These are the guidelines to help control the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. But as VOA's Arash Rabasadi reports, an anti-mask movement threatens containment.
Friday in Sturgis, South Dakota, the 80th annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally rolled into town despite public health concerns of COVID-19. Rallygoers didn't seem concerned about the advice of public health experts who say social distancing and mask wearing are key to controlling the spread of the virus that's now infected more than 5 million Americans.
No, we didn't take any precautions as we normally don't. We think the majority of this situation is manufactured. There's ulterior motives behind it.
Rallygoers like Jim Bush call risks of contagion overblown, despite mountains of public health evidence to the contrary.
And good afternoon. My administration has...
President Donald Trump has worn a mask in public on rare occasions. Leading U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci says safety regarding the coronavirus is simple.
That avoid crowds of any type, no matter where you are, because that leads to the acquisition and transmission. And I don't judge one crowd versus another crowd. When you're in a crowd, particularly if you're not wearing a mask, that induces the spread.
Yet a growing movement around the world challenges science and expert advice like those at this anti-mask rally in Stuttgart, Germany.
I'm here because I believe in Jesus Christ. This whole coronavirus is an anti-Christ issue. It is mostly against our Savior, Jesus Christ. Many don't know that. They don't know that it is really against God.
Others call for personal responsibility in protecting public health.
I think it's so selfish. Actually, these rules are necessary at this period of time. Otherwise, this virus can spread so easily. Maybe for younger people, it's not that much awful or dangerous. but on purposely we can affect other people.
Locals estimate the crowd in Stuttgart at around 2,000, while back in South Dakota, local officials expect roughly 100,000 visitors to the 10-day Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, which usually draws about 500,000 attendees. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
A gathering of senior Afghanistan leaders, or Loya Jirga, came to a decision on Sunday about the release of 400 Taliban prisoners. Reuters' David Doyle has this update.
Afghanistan agreed on Sunday to release 400 hardcore Taliban prisoners, paving the way for the beginning of peace talks aimed at ending 19 years of war. And it's a controversial move. The Afghan government had already released 4,600 of a promised 5,000 Taliban prisoners, but paused over the remaining 400, who were accused of carrying out some of the country's bloodiest attacks. But under pressure from US President Donald Trump, himself looking for an election year deal that would bring American troops home, Afghanistan's Grand Assembly, or Loya Jirga, approved the release. In a resolution, the Assembly said that was to remove an obstacle, allow the start of the peace process, and an end of bloodshed. Minutes later, President Ashraf Ghani said he would sign the release order. In a February pact allowing for the withdrawal of US troops, Washington and the Taliban agreed on the release of the prisoners as a condition for the talks with Kabul. Western diplomats said those talks will begin in Doha this week, and Ghani has appealed for a complete ceasefire before they begin. In 2019 alone, more than 10,000 civilians were killed or injured in the conflict, bringing total casualties in the past decade, according to a UN report, to over 100,000.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And on behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe. And good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As Asia battles the COVID-19 pandemic, USAID continues to provide essential health and other types of assistance in the region, including interventions to help curb the spread of COVID-19 disease within the region. Over the last half century, the United States has been the biggest contributor of global health security, said USAID's Assistant Administrator for Asia, Gloria Steele. We have built the foundation upon which the global health system is based, contributing to more than $140 billion in global health assistance in the 21st century. Today's world of increasing interconnectivity and mobility accelerates the shared global risk to our health. An infectious disease like COVID-19 can be transported from an isolated village to major cities on all continents in less than 36 hours. Public health emergencies can have devastating effects on local, regional, and global economies. They disrupt markets, destabilize political structures, threaten business operations, and endanger workers' health. This is why the United States invests in global health security.
Since the start of the pandemic, USAID and the State Department have committed more than $1 billion globally. And in Asia alone, that has amounted to $182 million to about 30 countries in the region.
Long-term investment in the healthcare systems of these countries has allowed for rapid mobilization of response to COVID-19.
We have generally been investing in prevention and treatment of infectious diseases, investing in improving maternal health and child health, and of course, investing in global health security. Previous investments have been the platform upon which we have been able to launch the assistance that we have given in the health arena since the start of COVID.
In Indonesia, for example, in just a few weeks, we were able to mobilize and train pharmacists, over 70,000 of them, to be able to provide clients advice as well as referrals for hospitals when necessary, said Assistant Administrator Steele.
The same thing has happened in India, where we used our maternal and child health platform to be able to advise mothers about prevention of COVID among their children, and then also about good health practices in maternal health and in child health.
We invest significantly in health and education. This allows the greatest number of people to participate in the growth process, said Assistant Administrator Steele. When the health systems are not protected, they affect everything else, not just the human ability to participate, but the growth of the economy in the process. And so that is our strategy in the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.